the way
that we decided that we're going to handle this, Councillor Offord, just so you understand what we're going to do, is we'll take, I'll ask the commissioners to give you any general questions about your evidence first, and then we'll go submitter by submitter, rather than go all over the show. And so we weigh other things, so we get one map on the wall, talk about it, then move to the next one. So, Commissioner Munro, would you like to start? Any general questions you may have?
Thank you, sir. Look, I think in your summary you responded pretty well to the question more strategically of edges and what have you. It was your summary that really inspired the question, so I don't think we need to traverse that anymore. What I would like some additional guidance with, though, is in the case of Wanaka, I haven't quite got my head around, from a whole of town perspective, where its arrival points are, where its departure points are, the basis for some of the experiences on which some rezonings may or may not be favoured. And so, without wanting to give you a terribly open-ended blank canvas to try and fill in, it would be great if you could just take me through and around the main roads into and out of Wanaka and just take me through where you think those key thresholds and qualities are.
Okay, well, starting with the Cardrona Valley Road,
yeah.
I think I've said in my evidence that I think there's a change in character to a more rural living character at the intersection with Riverbank Road, and then you have a sense of arrival at urban Wanaka when you get to the name of the hotel there, the motel.
I agree.
All good.
Yes.
That's sort of Orchard Road.
Yes, at Orchard Road. Yes.
Okay.
Where you have, more dense urban form at that point. Coming on State Highway 6, and then on State Highway 84 into town. I think you have a sense of arrival once you cross the Cardrona River, that you're coming into a settlement. But my understanding is that over the years there has been a lot of effort put into maintaining the amenity and some level of rural character of State Highway 84 between the intersection at where State Highway 6 turns right, the intersection with Riverbank Road there, through to the roundabout.
Sorry, when you say roundabout,
roundabout, sorry, I haven't got a map with me. Once you get right into...
I think you mean the Anderson Road line.
So that has been with building restriction areas. You have Mount Iron, and then building restriction areas. And then on the left side of the road, you've got rural lifestyle zoning. You've got Puzzling World, which is a, interrupts that character. And then you have an open space setback in the free park zone and the golf course. So there's been a lot of effort put into maintaining some kind of a high level of amenity for that entry to the town. In terms of coming from Glen Duguay, I think you get a change in character at Ruby Island Road. You've got rural lifestyle development on your right as you're coming in there, and more intensive rural activities on your left at the Blennerhassett property and at the Ripon Vineyard. And then once you reach the low density menu, that's a transition, and then you're in the urban Wanaka once you get to the more intensive residential development.
Well, thank you for that. And just working through them now, I can understand the Cardrona Valley Road transition from Riverbank up to Orchard, mm-hmm. and then from Orchard, really, it's urban. And so that's really that's really a progression, isn't it, of two
yes.
experiences. The State Highway 6 one was the one I'm really glad you spent some time on, because that's the one I have the most difficulty is the wrong word, confusion is maybe, in terms of what's trying to be achieved. In some parts it seems to be about Mount Iron. As you say, there's a whole bunch of things going on, and I think one of your conclusions in respect to the Aubrey Farm submission was maybe an existing building restriction area along a lower area of that land. I think you talked about the bit from Rob Roy Lane through to the Anderson Road roundabout.
Yes. Aubrey Road or Allenby?
Allenby. naughty me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I just want to understand, you get to the river, then there's a reasonably urban standard highway roundabout slash intersection going off to here. A puzzling world. I'm trying to understand where the landscape sensitivity is about defining an edge or arrival, where it's about Mount Iron, and where it's just about a historical idea that the road should just be wide and open.
It's a difficult question. I think, you know, a lot of it is there's been historical things that have tried to maintain that, and think about this a moment before I answer. I think in terms of an arrival, the arrival is when you cross the Cardrona and come. But to me that's when you know you're in Wanaka.
Yeah.
But the process of arrival carries on after that, and the character of that experience of arriving in Wanaka is enhanced by those things that I've talked about previously. Mm.
And is it your view, especially when we're considering those submissions that relate to the State Highway 6 stretch between the river and Anderson Road roundabout?
Yes.
That journey or process of arrival is A, remains sufficiently intact, and B, is of sufficient importance that it should be retained?
I do think that it's sufficiently intact, and I think from reading, you know, Wanaka 220 and previous community documents, that sense of arrival is important to the community and is valued by the community, because it has been consistently included in those documents as something that the community wishes to protect.
Mm-hmm. And specifically turning to the Allenby submission and that lower terrace quite close to Anderson Road, currently there's an open space setback from the highway, but one can see the line of houses on the top of the quite plainly. Is that really the key reason why you think some development in that part of their site?
It is.
Effectively, it's already there.
Yes.
Yep. Okay, well, thank you. That was all I had in terms of more general questions.
Could I just follow up on that point? You may not know the answer to that, but when those houses that appear beyond the lower point of the Allenby property were consented, was it understood, appreciated, accepted that they would be visible from the State Highway, in effect interrupting that view?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question.
Find somebody with sufficiently grey hair on the council team to remember that far back.
No, I don't know the answer to that question.
Well, we'll
I can stick my hand up because I've got the only grey hair in the room.
Oh, I'm not sure that's correct.
I don't think it is correct. That's why.
We'll discuss that with Mr. Clue, who was the applicant. You might have the opportunity to quiz him on that subject.
Sure we will.
Any general questions?
No, not general.
I've got one. I think you are right with regard to just following on from the coming at the entrance, the approach to Wanaka, that there was a community buy into that openness. Is it your opinion that you can see a distinct line of houses on the ridge line, but if that was to be brought down, that would be much more intrusive?
Yes, I agree. It would be more intrusive. Yes.
One little question, which is a general question, which is, if you're looking at landscapes, which is, and it's O&Ls, O&Fs in general, is there any, do you ever turn your mind to the productive capacity of the soil? So I'm thinking in terms of the Hawiya application, and there's two submitters that have asked to subdivide, and there's quite a, I forget the name of the road, there's a definite edge.
Cemetery Road.
I think it's Cemetery Road. There's a definite edge, and this side of Cemetery Road, the soils are actually some of the best in the country. Do you ever turn your mind to that?
Usually, landscape architects, it's a separate assessment. Effects on productive capacity of the soils, and it's not usually taken into account in landscape and visual effects assessment. Yeah. It may come into possibly come into play in terms of, you know, what the future of that land may be, and therefore, you know, rural amenity or reverse sensitivity effects possibly, but not otherwise.
I'm just wondering, does it sit within your remit as a capacity, or is it something that you would ask another professional to have a look at?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
Yes.
There you go. Was that a yes you'd ask another professional?
Yes.
I thought that's what I got from it. That's all in terms of generals.
The only general questions I had arose out of your summary, which are relatively specific, but I'd like to handle them first. The first is, in relation to your recommendation that the Clutha River corridor be shifted from O&F to O&L. Is there a submission seeking that? And if there's not, does that raise a scope issue? Then at that point, feel free to look to your left and partly pass the second question over, but hopefully you know the answer to the first.
Because while Mr. Cooper has sought that all outstanding classifications be removed from his land, his expert witness, Mr. Espy, has discussed the boundaries of outstanding natural features and outstanding natural landscapes in his evidence. Sorry, can I just...
Of course.
Refer to that. I have too much evidence. It's hard to find.
I certainly sympathise with that.
Mm-hmm.
I would confirm that he has only sought a smaller ONF rather than an ONL.
You want to make a submission on
the scope? Oh, Mr. Chair, I was just clarifying whether that was the submission that Ms. Nelsop was referring to or the position set out in the CEC's evidence. And it's the latter that Ms. Nelsop was referring to.
Yeah.
I would also clarify that part of the landscape that I've referred to as an ONL was notified as an ONL in the district plan, it being the area of land where the Devon Dairy irrigated fields are, and also the Department of Conservation, and also on the western side of the Hawea River, the land carrying on from the confluence of the Clutha and the Hawea to the west into the Sunny Heights land.
Yes, the bit that I'm interested in is the, get my directions right, the east part of the Cooper land where the question is effectively which terrace you put a line on and on what basis. So, Ms. Scott, I think that if you, I'd ask you to think about that and tell me whether or not there's a scope issue changing from ONF to ONL, because my read of the argument that I suspect we will hear in the fullness of time from Mr. Todd will be it's not an ONF, and there's no scope to make an ONL.
Yes, I will go away and look at that. Just one comment to make, so you have it in mind as you ask those questions, is that the framework that applies to both of those features is one and the same?
Well, I think Ms. Nelson's recommendation is that they're one and the same, but they're not notified as one and the same.
Yes, I'm referring to the actual rule framework that's sitting in Chapter 21 of the PDP.
That may be part of your answer, that they are the same rule framework, and therefore, on that basis, there is scope. And I think as notified, the policy framework is different for features as opposed to landscapes, although there are, of course, a lot of similarities.
Yes. So we'll look to cover that in our reply. Thank you, sir.
Well, if you could cover that. And at the end of paragraph 10 of your summary, Ms. Nelsop, the sensitivity of the moraine. The question I had is it sensitive because of the fact that the Peak Heights development is already sitting on it for further development? Is that where the sensitivity comes from, or is there another cause?
It's sensitive because of its geological and landscape significance as a feature, but I agree it is also sensitive because there has already been a reasonable amount of residential development on that moraine, not just at Peak Ridge, but also further to the south. And there will be further development further to the south as part of the district plan, I understand. And so that means that it's sensitive to the cumulative effects of further development.
Okay, that was all I had. I think we'll go into your evidence now. And as I say, We'll do these submitter by submitter. So the first section is we're talking the first section of section 5, which is about landscape categorisation.
Yes.
Start on the right this time. Commissioner Hutton, on section 5 of this Nelson's evidence.
I do have a question about the classification, but it relates specifically to one submission that of Roger Gardner, which we can leave until we get to that point if you prefer.
Happy to do it on that basis. I had a question bounce off about your paragraph 5.2.
5.2?
Yes, of your evidence achieved.
Yes.
Now we... You've quoted here from the Parkins Bay decision.
Yes.
And we'll, and this of course lends itself, it's particularly an issue in relation to the Cooper properties, but it also arises in others. If the question that's rolling around in my mind is that striking topography or cultural or associative values might overcome in effect a pastoral landscape, or the lack, or the relative lack of naturalness in the pastoral landscape. Does it have to be, as the environmental put, striking topography? Would ordinary topography be sufficient? At what point in the, like you're balancing a whole lot of considerations under Pigeon Bay,
yes.
And if it's at the lower end of naturalness because of the extent of cultivation, how far does that have, that push up the ante on the other considerations to reach a conclusion that it's still outstanding? That's a very
different question. It's difficult like because, the Pigeon Bay matters are quite complex, and there's a number of different matters, and when you're undertaking an assessment using those matters, you're balancing up all those different criteria, and natural character is an important component of determining whether a landscape is an outstanding natural landscape, but it is not the only one, and there are a number of other criteria. It is a balancing exercise, and if a landscape has a lower level of natural character, naturalness, yes, there must be other values or elements or features that bring it into the category of outstanding.
And the proposition I wanted to test with you is that I think it may have been Parkins Bay where the Environment Court said an O&L is a natural landscape that's outstanding rather than
an
outstandingly natural landscape.
Yes.
And I wondered if there was a conflict between that you have to meet a certain point of naturalness in order to satisfy the test of outstandingness, is where all those other Pigeon Bay factors go. Do you have to reach a threshold of naturalness before you move to the second phase?
Well, I think I've said a couple of times in my evidence that I don't believe that's the case, and I don't think that's a two-step process. I think it's an integrated process of considering all the factors. And I mean, it's obvious that an urban landscape cannot be an outstanding natural landscape. There is a lower level of natural character that would not be included as an outstanding natural landscape. But yeah, I do not think there's a two-stage process.
But once you get over that threshold that you can immediately discard, then it's everything else is in the mix.
Yes.
And I wondered if there was another. I have the example of the decisions on the Cabrona Valley, and indeed, a little closer to home, the one that Dr. Reed had talked about today, Fernburn Flats,
yes,
where the unnatural bit is such a small bit and is dominated by the natural bits.
Mm.
Over that might be another example.
Yes, I mean, most outstanding natural landscapes have areas within them that are modified to some degree, and it's a question of how large is that area of modification, and does it dominate the landscape character, or is it subservient to the overall character of the landscape?
And write that down. Using those same terraces on the Cooper property as an example, the ones to the east rather than the fan confluence, just to be clear where we are. The ones opposite, like west of Lugger. Another point Dr. Reed observed was how incised the river is in that landscape, and the fact that you have to be practically on top of it before you can see it.
Yes.
And in terms of that dominance, the question would be, do the irrigated pastured terraces above the river dominate the river, dominate that landscape because you can't see the river?
Sorry, I don't quite understand the question. Are you talking about the irrigated pasture?
On the Cooper side.
On the Cooper side, the first terrace above the river, or the next terraces above the river?
Well, that's a good question, because there is an intermediate terrace which is not cultivated, which has got a wetland in it, for instance.
Mm.
And and then further up again to the top terrace, which is pastured and irrigated. But the question is picking up on the way you just put it, that the issue is, does the modified part of the landscape dominate the unmodified part? And if you can't see the most valuable part of the landscape, what is dominating what? Which way around is it?
Well, I think when you're within the Clutha River corridor, you can see the river and you can appreciate it, and from the tracks, the public tracks that are available on both sides of the river. You are within that landscape, you're travelling through it, and you see both the river and the high enclosing escarpments around you, and that landscape is very legible when you're within it. I think perhaps if you're on State Highway 6, yes, you don't see down into that landscape, but when you're within that landscape, you're appreciating the whole of it.
Thank you, that's helpful. I'll just write this down, if you just give me a moment. Going to the first one is Alistair Munro, starting at paragraph 6.4.
Any starts?
That's a no. Roger Gardner, starting at 6.11 in the Young Family Trust. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that one. I've got a number of questions on Mr. Gardner's submission, specifically relating to the Wanaka Station Park area. I wanted to understand, and you may not be the right person to answer this, but I'm sure someone can help. The low-density residential zone that's in the PDP, is that a carryover from an urban zone in the operative plan, or is it a new urban zone that the PDP has introduced?
My understanding is it's from the operative district plan. That was my understanding, anyway, but I can't be definite about that.
And has that zone been taken up to any extent at this time, do we know? Or is it still sitting largely vacant?
My understanding is that that Wanaka Station Park is owned by the council.
Yeah.
We don't have an intention to develop it. That's my understanding.
My curiosity was the comment you've made, which I think is correctly interpreting what the council's done, that because it's got an urban zone, the landscape layer doesn't apply, paraphrasing it. And I found that a very, very, very puzzling position. I didn't think the council could nominate an urban zone to get out of Section 6 obligations. And so what I wanted to test with you is whether, if there was no urban zone on that land, you would have recommended that it wasn't or should be included in the UNL?
No, I would have still recommended it was outside because, in my opinion, it is parkland within the urban area rather than part of the lake edge.
And you think there is sufficient distinction between parkland with exotic trees, grass, wards, paths from farmland, which is often argued to be included in ONL, but which might include lots of exotic trees, grass, wards, paths, and so on?
I think it was more of the fact of its enclosure on three sides by urban development.
Right, okay. I think that's helpful. You'll really appreciate where I'm going to go here is to make sure we're approaching things on a very consistent basis. And so it's. So that must therefore also lend itself to the scale of the park relative to its urban enclosure.
Yes.
Otherwise, we'd never be able to call anything an ONL if it had urban development around it. Is that fair?
Yes. It's the context of that park with the residential surrounding it.
Okay, thank you.
Any more? Yeah.
Just one wee question on the moving the Ely Point ONL boundary in, and if you could expand a bit on your reasons behind that. Moving the Ely Point ONL from round Ely Point to back towards closer to the road. Could you expand on that just a bit?
Okay.
And because Ely Point is quite a visual promontory.
Yes, it is. Yes. And part of it actually being a promontory was behind my opinion that it should be included within the ONL.
Mm-hmm.
And also the fact that there was no real distinction in landscape character between the land that was included in the ONL and the notified plan and the landscape character of the higher part of Ely Point.
That's no argument. So. Interesting, because it is quite a, you know, it's Douglas fir, really nice eucalypt. Mm. But
the question I had was 6.19. You've expressed your recommendation on a qualified basis, and I suppose it's not really a question for you at all, but you said if it's considered that the submission in question seeks ONL classification of Bremner Bay to the north, you'd recommend that be accepted. My question to the team on that table is the council's view that the submission does or does not extend that far?
I'd have to have a look at that.
Add that to your list, please.
The submission was a little unclear because it referred to the reserves in the Wanaka Lakefront Reserves Management Plan, and it may be that the submitter intended, thought that those reserves were part of it, but they aren't actually included in the Reserves Management Plan.
And your figure one shows in blue what you would recommend the change to be if there was scope.
Yes.
Next one to section 7, Sir, firstly, Lake Hawea Township fringes, starting at paragraph 7.4.
I'm clear on that.
Is it my right? Commissioner McCloud?
No. Tickety-boo, thanks. Apart from the reproductive soils again and protecting the seed source. Which I've already asked.
All right. Move to Ranch Royale, starting at paragraph 7.16.
Just one really, and that is that Mr. Barr's planning recommendation, broadly following your advice about staying away from the highway in the upper part and just focusing on the lower slopes, instead of using one of the three parks zones, was to propose the large lot residential zone. Just to close the loop back to you, is that the zone you'd still be comfortable with?
Yes, I would be.
Thank you. That's all. Thanks.
Mr. Hudson?
Yeah, I'll hold this with mouth up. Just in terms of that particular submission and the others that seek rezoning adjacent land and down Riverbank Road, you've been very clear in your opinion this morning about where the arrival point is from State Highway 6. But I just wondered, given the visual prominence of the river, whether from an arrival perspective, it is actually the river that that forms a natural boundary at that intersection, beyond which got the Ranch Royale site and Puzzling World. I'm just trying to understand whether different people reach different conclusions about, you know, where they are based on the relative prominence of one feature versus another.
I think when people cross the river, there is very little residential or rural living development in sight at that point. The river's also not that highly visible from the bridge either. You know you're crossing the river, but you don't have amazing views up and down it. There's a lot of willows. And so in my opinion, it's only when you come up the bank and arrive at the intersection that you have a sense of arriving at in Wanaka at that point.
From taking a slightly broader view, with the development that is occurring in the immediate vicinity, including three parks and so on, I suppose this is at least as much a zoning question as a landscape question, but can it be seen that the existing natural landscape at that corner is slightly incongruous with an urban area that's under development?
At the corner with Riverbank Road?
Yeah.
I think I would say that the consented development on the corner of State Highway 6 has undermined that that the naturalness and the character of that area to some extent. But because you have Mount Iron straight in front of you, which is a dominant and very striking feature, I think it still retains quite a lot of amenity and natural character for that reason.
Thank you.
My question, bouncing off that, is you talked about the three parks setback. How much of three parks will ultimately be visible from the state highway? How far does the setback go?
I'm not sure of the exact distance of it. How much will be visible will really depend on what's planted in that setback, because at present you would see clearly, especially as you're travelling east from Wanaka, you would see clearly into the three park zone, and you can currently see the council's new sports centre there. I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with what whether there's any requirements for planting in that setback in the three park zone. But there is a major road intersection will be there that leads into three parks, and will travel through the open space setback.
So Tim Wallace Drive, in fact.
Mm. It will be less visible as you're approaching Wanaka, because it's kind of almost behind you. You know, as you're coming into Wanaka, you'll have to turn to the side to see into three parks.
I think most of us, and in your comment about arriving, are based on being in a vehicle. But how much does one's perception of a place change if you're on foot or on a bike?
I think it changes quite considerably. You're experiencing the landscape in much more detail, and observing it much more closely, and also your other senses are in play in terms of experiencing the landscape.
So again, looking at the transitional area between rural residential and then a fully urban setting, Ms. Nelson, how do you arrive at your conclusion based on these different perceptions as to whether or not you're a person walking or travelling through at speed. And then, I know this is pretty fundamental, but I'm just trying to get an understanding of in relation to the submissions we've had. These critical points where they're on the
front. You will take it into account, and often what you'll do is take into account how many people are actually going to be cycling and walking in that area. On an open state highway, you're likely to have very few cyclists and hardly any pedestrians. And in some other areas where there would be more pedestrian traffic, you would take it into account to a greater extent. My understanding is that my understanding of the background to the community's wish in Wanaka 220 and other documents to retain that the quality of that arrival into Wanaka was predominantly based on car-based vehicle arrival to Wanaka, rather than perhaps locals travelling, from Albert Town to town, or walking from Mount Iron into town.
Thank you.
So, going on to from that, in your rebuttal evidence as well, so you talk about this issue in the context of the. Now I'll go back to it. Come to that because I'm thinking about Allenby. So we'll deal with that at the time we talk about Allenby, having set down the rules. I'll try and follow them myself. That I want to go talk about on the other side of the Ranch Royal property, where you've recommended a setback from the boundary on the three parks side, and
yes.
And so that moraine hummock, this is your 7.19, makes an important contribution to the legibility of the landscape. Yes, I understand that point.
Yes.
But and to the visual amenity of the future urban areas to the south. And the question really is, if there's going to be a commercial area under the three park zone hard up against that boundary, I have difficulty understanding where the rationale for being concerned about visual amenity across the other side of the boundary. So perhaps you can explain that to me.
I agree that if commercial development, the lower part and on one part, the escarpment is only about 4 metres high, it would be obscured. And I would clarify that on that side, I think that retention of the moraine on the highway side is much more important than protection of the escarpment on the three park zone side.
Without wishing to put words in your mouth, so tell me if I'm wrong, are you saying that it's in the nice to have category?
I would agree with you, yes. It would be good to retain the legibility of that escarpment, but I don't think it is essential from a landscape perspective.
Worry about Mr. Seagrew's submission anymore. So we'll go to Beresford's submission. And the land formerly known as Sticky Forest.
Or the plantation.
Or both. Question of the land. No?
No.
No? Not quite up. I have one or two questions about this. That at 7.28, you talk about the forest of moraine ridge together with the VRAs and the various settings, the natural landscape setting and containment of central Wanaka, which is important for the amenity and character of the town. The question is, in the area of the Beresford land, obviously it's not Mr. Beresford, but you know what I mean, has that sense of containment, visual amenity of that feature being compromised by the North Lake development on, get my directions right, on one side, east, thank you, and Peninsula Bay on the west?
No, I don't think it has. Both those developments have taken care not to encroach onto the toe slopes of that moraine. To any great extent, there's a slightly more encroachment on the North Lake side. But in general, that urban development has protected the integrity of the moraine in that location.
And in terms of the grouping of submissions that we talked about yesterday, you may have left before that, talk about do we consider submissions individually or grouped. I'm interested in the connection between the Beresford submission and the Munro one. I understand your evidence is consistent on that point, so that's not an issue, but the point was, if we took a different view to you in relation to the Munro submission about retention of that VRA on the moraine, would it follow that the case for the Beresford development would be better or worse? Because that was
I think I've said previously in answer to your question that I think that feature is sensitive to cumulative effects, and so if the narrow bit of land between Peak View Ridge and the Kurimoko was rezoned, plus the sticky forest bit that's on Kurimoko within the VRA on there, if those were developed, then I think that would be a greater level of cumulative effect and make Beresford land more sensitive as a result.
I've already answered. I finished my head on that. Now, if you could turn to your rebuttal evidence, please, where you're discussing Mr. Field's evidence. And I have to confess, I got horribly confused studying these various plans, but at 3.10, and not your plans, I hasten to add, the ones that Mr. Beresford's witnesses have produced, I think I may have got to the bottom of this discussing with Ms. Scott, but I want to confirm your understanding as I discussed with Ms. Scott. I think that there are two lines. There's an orange line on Mr. Field's evidence, and a yellow line, and the orange one I think is what he's recommending, and the yellow one is what Mr. Crystal is putting forward on, effectively, in reliance on part two. Is that your understanding?
Yes,
is that
my understanding as well. So the orange dashed line is Mr. Field's recommended line, which I've accepted and support. The yellow line is the one sought in the revised submission, which neither Mr. Field nor I support.
And so if our collective understanding is incorrect and Mr. Field was advocating, I use that word in a non-pejorative sense, supporting the yellow line, you wouldn't agree with that?
No, I would not.
And Mr. Field expresses a degree of uncertainty about the placement of that line and said it would have to be surveyed because, of course, it's covered in trees, so it's a bit difficult to see where the landforms really are. Are you comfortable that it's near enough to the ridge line that we can rely on?
Yes, I am. I mean, that is also the case with many other O&L boundaries within the district that, you know, detailed survey could, you know, modify them slightly, but I'm comfortable that it is within the appropriate location, having examined the council's more detailed landform data.
Three 12, you're talking about visibility from Hidden Hills and Central North Lake of the proposed development. I want to put to you the rhetorical question, given the extent of development existing and proposed, consented and proposed, and indeed already happening, should we be concerned about visibility from that direction?
My concern about visibility from that direction was the integrity of the ridge line of the moraine as viewed from those areas, and that development didn't interrupt the integrity of that ridge line.
And are you confident that the revised or shrunk development area that you're supporting would do that?
No, I think I've said in my evidence that I have been conservative with that evidence, and I think it would maintain that ridge line integrity, but without a more detailed survey, I can't be absolutely sure.
Paragraph 314 of your evidence, rebuttal evidence, you talk about a considerably lower density of development being required. How much lower are we talking about?
in my view, rural zoning is the appropriate zone for that area of the site, and I consider there is some potential for rural living within that rural zone, subject to resource consent and assessment against the the detailed criteria in the rules of the district plan.
So is it the density of an RL zone that would be the issue, or a large lot residential for that matter, or the ambit of the controls and discretions not being wide enough to require?
Yes, the latter, that the ambit of the controls would not be great, sufficiently great.
I apologise if this is somewhere else in your evidence, because I do have the impression that I may have read it somewhere. May even have been very recently in Ms. Scott's submissions. But the question I was going to ask at the end of paragraph 3.17, what are the standards required in that North Lake development area hard up against the plantation block thereof? It is in your submission?
Yes, we did discuss this yesterday, that building restriction areas are in two adjacent areas, I believe, and it's referred to in Mr. Barnes' evidence as well.
All right, we'll pass on that one. All right, Alan B. Fowles. Question number eight. What's that, sorry? I was looking at the rebuttal and the evidence chief. Thank you for that correction.
I suddenly got totally confused while I was looking at it. Before Wolverton, can you indulge me? Can we just bounce back to 721 to the subgroup? So this is that triangle quite at the foot of Mount Iron, quite close to the river and the bridge and all those arrival experiences we've talked about so much today. And I just wanted to test with you the submitter's analysis about a landscape buffer to screen developments could be acceptable. I hope you agree with that.
Yes.
Mr. Barr, on the other hand, has recommended it should just stay the rural zone without a building restriction area or anything like that, and just rely on the rural zone's general landscape assessment. I just wanted to test with you whether or not, from a landscape perspective, it's better to put something like a building restriction area in the bank and have that certainty rather than leave it to the perhaps uncertain outcome of a future resource consent process, or whether you feel that specific considerations at the time of the resource consent might be better.
Before you answer that question, you appreciate that submission has been withdrawn?
No.
So by all means ask it as a general question, but be aware.
No, we don't need you then. Thank you.
Okay.
Stand down. Proceed to Hawthornden. Very good.
Now that we're all on the same page.
Okay, now that we are back on the same page, and we've got all different pages. Can you help me understand the changes to the ONL that you, the PDP ONL that you're recommending, are based on your interpretation of the previous court finding? So in effect, you're recommending that your proposal better reflects what the court was trying to achieve than the PDP. Is that right?
That's correct, but also from my opinion, from a consistent topographical edge to the ONL. However, I understand there was a question yesterday about whether those changes would be within scope, and I acknowledge that there is no submission seeking an extension to the bottom of that escarpment.
Yes. But just so I'm understanding where your recommendations are coming from.
I was trying to tidy up things, really, you know, from my perspective, trying to, you know, often
yeah.
you might get a line that's been translated from a marker pen line on a hand-drawn map, and it gets translated in a, and it's not really completely accurate to the topography of the site. So I was attempting to clean that up. But
How much of your preference for where the line should go came from the shadow of it being previously identified by the Environment Court? So let's just say the Environment Court hadn't previously said the line should be where it is. Would you still be as firmly of the view that it should be where you're?
Yes, I would be.
Yeah,
yeah. I fully support the inclusion of that area in the ONL. Yes.
In your rebuttal evidence, you paraphrase some of the commentary from Hawthorne's landscape park, Miss Ayres, Iris?
Ayres,
thank you. Miss Ayres. And you mentioned the potential restriction of farming operations as being one of the reasons fielded to change where the line might be.
Yes.
I wanted to talk with you about if the classification of an ONL, one finds that an area within that being used for some degree of domesticated farming or otherwise is still of sufficient overall character that it can be included in the ONL. Does it not follow that the effects of the operation of that can't be offensive to the ONL, or that wouldn't have been included in the ONL to start with? That is to say, is the ongoing use of farmland included in ONL?
Absolutely.
But to my mind, I'm just seeing the circle of logic I can't seem to break out of about if it's in, clearly the effects of its operation are compatible at the starting point.
Yes, I agree with you.
Right. Sorry, it was a very poorly worded question, but I'm glad we got it wrong. And so, what tolerance does that have, given that the operation of a farm might mean over time pastures change, shelter belts come and go or be shifted, stocking might change to orcharding, for instance, so over the line, you know, probably several years.
Mm.
Is that bundle of change, in your view, still part of that conclusion, or is it really just about farming operations continuing into the future, but really limited to kind of what's there at the start of that ONL determination?
Now, there's permitted activities in a rural area and part of normal farming activities, and in my opinion, those permitted activities would not change the classification of that land as ONL. They could, perhaps the one exception I might think of is if forestry, if a forest lot was planted over the whole of that land that completely obscured, that could possibly change its character sufficiently. But it's the only instance that I could possibly think of.
But does the PDP treat forestry as an activity different to farming?
I think it does.
So,
yes.
So that would take care of that.
We have to refer
to the planner. Sage nodding of the head there. So you're comfortable that were we to agree with your recommendation, any farming operations on that land could continue?
Yes, I am. Yes.
If we were to agree with the submission to change the line away from your recommendation, the previous court's determination, one of the things on my mind when dealing with district-wide matters like ONLs is the knock-on and the knock-on and the knock-on. So if we were to agree with the submission, do you think that could create uncertainty or undermine the integrity of the ONL elsewhere in the district that might be able to say there are like circumstances with the Hawthornden submission?
I can't really answer that question, I'm sorry.
Oh, no, it's a okay. It's a tough one, sure.
Yes.
Do you, in a more general sense, in the spirit of the question, feel that changes to the recommended ONL in one part of the district could undermine it elsewhere? Is it just a matter of landscape principle? Is it that sensitive, or is it not?
Because the determination of whether a landscape is an outstanding natural landscape is dependent on its particular context, it's difficult to extrapolate from one landscape to another.
I'll put my cards on the table, as it were. But for me, the key issue is if we were to agree with the submitter to change an ONL, amongst other things, but primarily for the reason that it impeded farm operations, would that create a circumstance where everyone else in the district with farming in an ONL said, hey, us too?
I think it could very well.
Thank you. I think that was really where I was going. I think that's all I have. Thank you.
Can I just expand a little bit on that? Not that you didn't expand it out. But you would say that the permitted activities in the rural area within an ONL, one being forestry, how would you feel about pivot irrigators?
Do you want my personal or my professional view?
I'll settle for the latter, please.
I understand that they're permitted activities in the district. They change the character of the landscape.
Indisputably, one of the we've just been discussing Cooper and River Flats.
Yes.
And this is obviously a totally different scenario, and I totally get the fact that every ONL is different in its own, and this is specific. So whether the impact of the public irrigators on the Clutha River that are seen in a grander versus the pivot irrigator as a permitted activity on an ONL in this area. It's rather different.
Are you asking what I would think if there was a pivot irrigator on the fan?
Yes.
that would increase the contrast between the colour of the fan and the upper part of Mount Alpha, but I think that the distinctiveness of that fan as a feature would still be legible and important in the visual integrity of the mountain slope as a whole.
I think you and I share the same personal opinion, but we'll move on.
Scott, continuing from that on that theme that the Commissioner McLeod raised about pivot irrigators, I have to confess I haven't read the 13 Environment Court decisions on the Mackenzie Basin. But since you've been good enough to give us the last one, which I also haven't read, what did the Environment Court conclude? Because I have in mind that area between Twizel and Amarama, that's a particularly vivid, to the layperson at least, or to this layperson, change in landscape character as a result of pivot irrigation.
I will have to have a look at the decision specifically in relation to what where it landed. It basically said no more. It recommended a moratorium on any further irrigation. That decision was provided in the context of its reference to the Beresford submission, so in quite a different context.
Is that a truth and confession? Have you ever read it either?
Mr. Winchester did appear at that hearing. I didn't, and I wasn't involved in it in any way. I have read parts of it, and I have plenty of summaries about it, but I don't have a specific answer to your question, but I will get that.
Thank you. I think that given that I suspect we will hear a lot about Philip Alligators from counsel for Mr. Cooper, that would be of assistance.
Yes, okay.
No. Now, Mr. Alsop, I want to talk to you about your paragraph 7.40 of your evidence in chief. You're talking here about the proposed rural residential zone and the fact that it would be an extension, from a landscape perspective, it would be an extension of the large lot development that's zoned over the road. And I want to ask you more at a more general level, more a higher level, if, like the submitters contending that a rural residential land would be a transition, and Commissioner Monroe's already pursued that line of thinking, but from your perspective, from a landscape perspective, if a rural residential zone doesn't provide a transition, do you have a view on what the role of rural residential zone, the rural residential zone is? It's a very open question, but I'm trying to get to grips with, if it's not a transition, what is it? And when is it appropriate?
I would say that a rural residential zone might be appropriate where the retention of rural amenity is not particularly important. Because in my view, rural residential density development does not retain rural amenity to any great extent.
That's helpful. And going to your rebuttal, about at the bottom of page 17 of your rebuttal evidence about the earthquake provisions. This is again.
My rebuttal evidence?
Yes, your rebuttal evidence. Earthworks rather than earthquake. Far buildings in the O&L below 600 MASL as permitted, so long as they meet standards. What's the elevation of the top part of Orthendon?
It's below that level.
That's all I need to know.
Yes.
It's less than 600.
Yeah.
And in terms of your discussion in paragraph 336. You've drawn attention to the escarpment that's clearly visible on your photograph 4.
Yes.
And the question that occurred to me, and this may be where you talk about the interruption to the escarpment, when we were on our site visit, we started at the western end and we were trying to figure out, looking up the hillside, where the proposed O&L line was.
Mm-hmm.
and we ended up speculating that it was in the middle, effectively in the middle of a paddock. Mm-hmm. And then we went the other side of the shelter belt of trees where the escarpment is. Mm. I said, well, it's clearly obvious there. Mm. And we wondered whether, and we reasoned back and said where we thought it was probably about right. Mm. So is the track my thinking is going is effectively, are you both right? If, depending on where you're standing on the property, at the western edge, it's not at all clear on a landscape setting mm-hmm. where your O&L line is, mm-hmm. whereas further east, it's very clear. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, I get the impression, well, you're both right, depending on where you're standing at it, on the property. So so that's a roundabout way, and I'd invite your comment. And well, is that in fact factually the case? And where you have that point where there's a clear landscape feature at one point and there's an interruption, is it legitimate just to drive the line across?
I acknowledge that, especially Centre Creek, the fan of Centre Creek interrupts the escarpment. But I think from more distant viewpoints, particularly from within Wanaka Central and from elevated viewpoints such as Mount Iron, that interruption does not, undermine the integrity of the fan feature as defined by the escarpment. To the west of the Centre Creek fan, the escarpment continues, and then the O&L line actually goes up the edge of the Stony Creek fan. So it doesn't cross the Stony Creek fan, it goes up the edge of it to meet the steeper slopes. So the area where it is not clearly defined is the Centre Creek fan. And in answer to your question, yes, I do think it is appropriate to link the two parts of the escarpment on either side across that fan on the basis of its legibility from more distant viewpoints.
Final question on Hawthornden relates to your paragraph 339, and feel free to
3.39, yep.
And feel free to pass the question to the lawyers and the planners. This is the second top line on page 22, they're saying that the versions of a rural residential zone do not provide certainty that covenants and conditions on these subjects would be imposed. And the rhetorical question I've written in the margin is certainty required? And is it possible that they would do so?
I think it's possible, but my comment was on the fact that, that Ms. Ayres was relying on those aspects of the proposal and her assessment.
Well, on that happy note, at 1:02, we'll adjourn until 2.
Before we adjourn, sir, could I ask just a general question of the Scott, following on from
that
comment? Just something to think about. Notwithstanding that particular instance, there have been a number of submissions where either experts on behalf of the submitter or council staff assessing said submissions have identified specific outcomes that are effectively being relied on to support the relief being sought, or the action being taken. I'd be interested in, not right now, it's lunchtime, but the council's view on, in such circumstances, whether the direct follow-through to planning requirements that would absolutely guarantee those would happen, distinct from may happen, would be a requisite for us agreeing with recommendation to accept or reject, as the case may be.
Yes, I've taken a note on that following from your question yesterday, and I'll be including that in full in the response by the end of the week, so
thanks.
Certainly.
Well, now we definitely will adjourn.